Okay, so thanks for coming to this seminar. I'm going to, as you can see from the title, I'm going to discuss the large end limit of strongly interacting gauge theories in two different setups, namely in 3 plus 1 and in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And in particular, I will focus on the properties at finite temperature. And so this is based, the method that I've used to do this study is based on lattice simulations. And I've done some comparison of observables such as the equation state and polyakov loops and so on, also to some holographic models. So I will first of all discuss why it is interesting to look at the large end limit and what we can learn from the lattice, where one can simulate these theories for any arbitrary number of colors, of course, up to computer power limits. And then we'll also try to make a comparison with some of the models that are available in the literature and what one can learn about what these models tell us and how the information that one can derive analytically or semi-analytically from holography can be combined with the lattice simulations. So the plan of the talk is the following. First, I will give a general introduction, and then I will discuss some details about a specific holographic model that have been comparing my my results for the equation of state with, and this is the so-called improved holographic QCD model, which is a bottom-up model that has been proposed a few years ago by Elias Kyritsis and his collaborators. Then, okay, we'll give some details about how the simulations are done, including the parameters and so on. And then we'll present the section of the, with the results for the equation of state in 3 plus 1 and in 2 plus 1, and then also some new results for the polyakov loops. This is somehow less directly related to holography, but it's interesting because from the point of view of large n arguments on its own. And finally, the conclusion. So here is a list of works on which this talk is based on. Essentially, the equation of state in 3 plus 1, then these are the works with the Turing group and with people from Regensburg and from CERN, where I where we studied the equation state in 2 plus 1, and finally with Anne and Kari, we are currently looking at the polyakov loops.
Why polyakov loops are not related to holography? There are
relations also. Yeah, there are also, but less.
So we don't discuss this.
No, actually, in the paper and in the proceeding that we have out, we mentioned this, but yeah. I will mostly focus on different things like the Casimir scaling and the property of the renormalized loop. Actually, the renormalization properties are also related to holography in a way. There are arguments why, but yeah, I will. Okay, so let me first introduce. Okay, these are very well known things that. So just essentially due to asymptotic freedom, one expects that when the temperature or the density of hadronic matter becomes sufficiently large, then hadronic matter should cease to exist and should undergo a change of state to the confined phase. This has been studied in an extensive program via heavy ion collisions since the 80s. And what we have, the evidence that has been gathered essentially in the last 15 years is that indeed at temperatures around 160 MeV, there is the creation of this fireball of deconfined matter, and it looks like this quark gluon plasma behaves as an almost ideal fluid. It has been dubbed the most perfect liquid observed in nature because the viscosity values are strikingly low. Now, of course, the natural tool that one would expect to use to describe this this system is the perturbative one, but there is a problem that in it's a general feature of Fermat gauge theory is that the perturbative computations are hindered by the existence of infrared divergences. Essentially, no matter how high the temperature is, you always have long wavelength modes that are always strongly coupled, always non-perturbative in nature. And this shows up in various aspects related to the non-analyticities of these perturbative expansions. And there is also the so-called Linde problem, which is related to this, namely the fact that at some stage there is a breakdown between the usual expansion in powers of the coupling and the expansion in number of loops. These are all aspects of the same problem related to these infrared divergences. And from the practical point of view, one also notices that the convergence of perturbative expansions is not good near TC, and the critical the temperature typical of the where the confinement region is, and this is also related to the fact that the physical coupling there is small but not extremely small, and therefore the perturbation the perturbative computations break down there. So this calls for for non-perturbative tools, and so to study the quark gluon plasma in these strongly interacting regime, there are essentially two main tools. The first is based on lattice simulations, and this has the advantage that it's an approach which is really based on the first principles of QCD. And essentially, there is a number of approximations that one has to take into under control. For example, okay, there are of course statistical error bars in the simulations, but also one has to take care of doing all of the continuum limit, infinite volume, and physical mass extrapolations to have really physical results. But these are all under control. So now with the computer power that's available, this is not a problem anymore. However, the disadvantage of the lattice simulation approach is that one gets numbers, but not necessarily or not always some deeper understanding of what's happening, no? From these numbers, one doesn't really necessarily understand why something happens, okay? So, also another disadvantage is that the lattice approach is based on the Euclidean regularization of, there are typically phenomena like those related to real-time dynamics that cannot be directly studied in this approach. So one has to search for some way to go around this. Another problem is the one related to simulations at finite chemical potential. This is only possible reliably in general in a quite a narrow region of values of mu. On the other hand, a different approach is of course the one based on holography, and this is, as you all know, stemmed from the so-called Maldacena conjecture that dates back to the late 90s. And the idea is, of course, to apply this duality between gauge theories and string theory to derive some of the properties of these strongly coupled gauge theories in a regime in which computations on the string side can be done easily because they essentially reduce to gravity computations in a higher dimensional space. So, of course, this is in general analytical or semi-analytical, and it can be applied to study a large number of physical observables, also those that cannot be probed directly or easily on the lattice. There are a couple of caveats, however. For example, this conjecture has not been rigorously proven yet, although at least for the n equals 4 super young means, there is really a lot of mathematical evidence supporting it. Okay, but there are of course also models which try to extend this conjecture to other types of theories and with a various level of mathematical rigor. Also, another aspect is that essentially, I will discuss a bit more about this later, all the computations are based on one approximation here, that's the approximation that the number of colors is infinite. So there, it's well known that this seems to work fine for several observables, and there is phenomenological evidence since the 70s essentially that the Largen limit is indeed a good approximation to QCD, but in principle this is something that could depend on the observable that one studies. So essentially the idea of my work is to combine somehow the first principle simulations on the lattice with the insight that we can get from holography, and to see whether this this approximation is reliable or not. Okay, I mentioned already why large N is interesting for holographic computations, but of course there are many more motivations. There is much more motivation to it, and the interesting feature essentially is that the large N limit of generic quantum field theory is characterized by the fact that there are some factorizations of expectation values of physical observables, and therefore essentially it can be interpreted as a classical limit. In practice, it's possible to construct mathematically the meaning of this physical statement can be made more precise by going to, for some simple system at least, basis of coherent states and showing that essentially 1 over n is a parameter which in this limit maps the fully interacting quantum field theory to a certain classical limit. The details are discussed in this nice review by Larry Affe of the early 80s. But in general, more specifically for QCD, the large N limit is also interesting because it reveals in a very simple way a lot of not so obvious or non-trivial, at least, phenomenological aspects. For example, the Ozzie rule and some properties related to mesons and also baryons and so on and so forth. And this is the limit in which n is taken to infinity and with the g square n fixed. So this is the tough limit. I will not consider the Veneziano limit, although it's also possible. So in my case in particular, I will in my simulations, I always run simulations without dynamical fermions. So essentially in this limit what one finds is that there is...
You meant the quiet approximation? Or?
Yeah. I just simulated Young Mills. Actually...
Some particular ends.
Yeah.
We'll go to limit later.
Yeah. And also the thing is that in fact the... simulating only Young Mills, the approach to the planar limit is faster. So okay, if one studies this limit, well, essentially what one finds is the dominance of planar diagrams. In particular, that means that the amplitudes for physical processes can be expressed in double expansion, not only in powers of the coupling, but also in powers of n. So the diagrams that dominate are those that can be drawn on a sphere, and the others are subleading. So, yeah, this is also related to some properties associated to integrability, especially, for example, in the case of n equals 4, this shows up quite in a neat way. In fact, in lower dimensional cases, especially in 1 plus 1 dimensions, it's also possible to derive analytical solutions in the Largen limit. Unfortunately, this is not the case for QCD in 3 plus 1. It's not solvable, but in lower dimensions there are some exact results. Also, there is a long debated issue that's related to the volume reduction at large n. So this proposal was initially put forward by Eguchi and Kawai. Actually, soon afterwards it was found that it doesn't work just because there is a spontaneous breakdown of center symmetry if one... So the idea is that you could study theories, these large n theories, in an arbitrarily small volume. But a necessary condition is that the center symmetry should not break down, but instead we know that it does. So there have been a couple of fixes that have been proposed later, the twisted and the quenched Eguchi-Kawai, but they have also been proven to fail recently. And finally, a few years ago, there has been a new proposal by Kovtun, Unsal, and Yaffet to add some trace deformation terms to fix this problem. So this is an aspect that comes out in also in the Largen limit. Finally, for the phase diagram, there is also potential implication that has been discussed, and it's so-called quarkionic matter that has been proposed by McLaren and Pizarski. And this is related to the existence of, this is related to large densities. So I will not discuss specifically this case. So what I'm doing, what I've done essentially, is I fixed my lattice setup to study only SUNian mean spheres, and I want to test the dependence on the number of colors in the regime at finite temperature, where the theory is still strongly coupled, so relatively close to TC. And I've done this with the lattice simulations, and there are, let me also take this occasion to advertise some other excellent works that have been done in this context by Lucini, Tepper, and Wenger, then Barak Brinkholz and Mike Tepper, and more recently by Dutta and Gupta. So this is more or less in a general line of work that has been boosted a lot by the work by Tepper and collaborators, and it's summarized in a review of 3 years ago. So in particular, my interest, as I said, is also to do a comparison with some holographic models. And apart from this, there are also other interesting features that it's worth investigating, these simulations with a different number of colors, in particular those related to non-perturbative contributions, either to the free energy, namely to the pressure of the system, but as we will see, also possibly to the Polyakov loops. Then I also, more recently, we also looked at the generalization to the lower dimensional case. This is interesting because some of these non-perturbative features actually I mean, to understand where they come from, it would be interesting to look at what happens in lower dimensions, okay? Is this universal or not? Also, of course, looking at lower dimensional cases could, and doing comparisons with holographic models could possibly have some relevance for applications of holographic tools to condensed matter system. This is still open in a way, it's, but okay. Finally, as I mentioned, I will also discuss a bit about the Polyakov loops, in particular looking at the Casimir scaling and later also at the properties of the renormalized Polyakov loops. So, okay, let me say a couple of words about one of the models that I've mostly discussed. So this is, as I mentioned, the model proposed initially by Kiritsis and his collaborators. This is a bottom-up model, which is based on this five-dimensional gravity action, and the idea is to construct a potential for the dilaton field that we have here, such that it reproduces the dynamics of Young-Mills, essentially, both in the ultraviolet and in the infrared. Once this is fixed, of course, this requires some choices and some assumptions. But once the potential is chosen, in principle, one has predictions for all of the quantities of the theory, so the spectrum, the thermodynamics, and also other quantities. But I will neglect this. So, okay, one issue here is that when they constructed this, then they fixed some of the parameters of this potential by comparing with some low energy results from the lattice for SU3. And the idea is that by doing so essentially what they use holographic tools to study this, the classical gravity limit of this. And you see here, the point is that there is this quantity, this effective five-dimensional Newton constant that has this form. And if you take the limit for n going to infinity, it becomes small, so the classical gravity approximation is reliable. But it turns out that for the parameters that they fitted, that they have in their potential, this is actually the scale for n equals 3, the scale is quite low. It's something like twice the lightest blue ball in the spectrum. So it's not obvious at all whether the construction is reliable if one cannot go to n equals infinity. So what I did was to test the dependence on n and then to see whether the comparison makes sense. So the specific choice for the dilaton potential that they make is this, and so you can construct the behavior that you expect in the limits in the ultraviolet and in the infrared, and with that you can fix, for example, the first two, the behavior in the ultraviolet, you can fix it by imposing that the dual model will be characterized by the same beta function that you have in SUN. And then for the infrared, you have two more parameters, at least, and they fix this using, if I remember, the value of the latent heat in SU3 from the lattice and the value of the scalar blue ball mass from the lattice. This is the observation that I mentioned. And this model it exhibits a first-order transition between a phase that's dual to the confined phase dominated by thermal gravitons to a phase characterized by a black hole. What they found is that the predictions for the other blue balls are in very good agreement with those that have been obtained in lattice computations. For example, I remember these numbers that they obtained were within something like 5 or 10% for the global masses. So it's quite a surprisingly good agreement at the quantitative level for a holographic model, with a relatively small number of parameters, because essentially just imposing this the behavior that the asymptotics that you expect in the ultraviolet and in the infrared in order to keep the potential as simple as possible, you have just 4 parameters. With this, of course, then you can also compute other quantities. Later they computed, for example, the bulk viscosity, the drag force, the jet quenching parameter, and so on. And it's also possible to play a bit with the model and to generalize it to different setups. For example, my friends from Helsinki have also used it to study theories which are relevant for walking dynamics. This has been done in a series of papers. And of course, actually, it's also possible then to include fermions. So this is supposed to be dual to Young-Mills, to pure Young-Mills, but it's also possible to include a setup where you have dynamical fermions, in particular in the Veneziano limit, so that they play a role. And since the world is a small place, it turns out that this has been done by my landlord, together with Elias. And okay, in the so one of the collaborators of Elias, Umut Gursoy, has done the last paper that we did together with him. He also constructed the generalization of this to the 2+1 case, just considering the simplest setup to get something. So I will show you a plot where we compare this model with the results for 2+1 also. Okay, a couple of words about lattice QCD. It's a bit technical, but okay. Let me skip the basic, the background. So, yeah. So essentially,
it's still introduction.
So, what we have, essentially, I just want to say that we have simulations with also with an improved action that reduces quite strongly the lattice discretizations. And this will be particularly important later for the, especially for the Polyakov loops. So the thermodynamics can be obtained just by standard methods, and then what essentially one does is to measure the pressure by measuring differences of the lattice action, and then one from the from the free energy density, so from the pressure, one obtains the other quantities using basic thermodynamic relations. This is for these equilibrium quantities. Then, okay, the definition of the Polyakov loop. I will be showing results for Polyakov loops in many different representations, and we use just standard group theoretical tools like the Weyl formula to obtain them. So it's not particularly demanding. Okay, the determination of the scale in the simulations is non-perturbative because we are close to the critical to the critical temperature. Essentially, what we have done, we have constructed. So we have to obtain the value of the lattice spacing at each value of the bare lattice coupling that we put in the simulations. And to do so, we first do some simulations at t equals zero, from which we extract the essentially the value of the string tension in lattice units. Okay, so this is a quantity that we extract, and that. Fixing this to be 440 MeV square gives us the value of the spacing in fermion. Okay, So let me show the results for the equation of state, first in 3 plus 1. So here I'm plotting the dimensionless ratio of the pressure over the fourth power of the temperature normalized to the Stefan-Boltzmann limit as a function of T over Tc. And the different colors are different gauge groups from SU3 up to SU8. And as you can see here, note that I'm normalizing through the Stefan-Boltzmann limit, namely I'm dividing also by the by an n squared minus 1 factor. And with this normalization, all of the data fall on the same, exactly on the same curve.
This looks like a continuous function,
yeah,
which would mean there's a critical exponent, which is just the slope of the line as it comes down.
Mm-hmm.
So what is that critical exponent?
We haven't fitted it because this is done only on one value of the volume.
Okay.
So I expect that...
it's first order transition.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was, a first order transition, so that's why I'm surprised to see what looks like critical behavior.
No, but if he plots epsilon, he will see.
Okay.
Yeah, there is the jump. I mean, but this is, of course, continuous, but yeah. But your question was about the behavior here?
Yes.
Okay, I will show you later. I have a plot of the derivative of this, essentially as how it goes with T. Okay, so this is the comparison with this improved holographic QCD model. So as I mentioned, they fitted one value of taken from the thermodynamic sector, but then the agreement is quite good throughout the all temperature range, at least in this temperature range. At higher temperatures, maybe there will be some deviations, but it's already a good agreement.
You didn't change parameters, it was just the Skirin system?
Yeah, I just asked them to send me the... Actually, what they did was the fit the... I mean, this curve is obtained using some values from SU3 from previous calculations, and the latent heat extrapolated from the large end limit, but from another work. So this is the behavior of this of the trace of the energy momentum tensor, which is related to the derivative of P. So essentially, yes, there is this the transition is of first order, and again, so what one can see here is that essentially for SU3 the transition is a bit more weakly first order. So it's that's what I was saying, that the finite volume effect, I mean SU3 is most sensitive to finite volume effects there. But still you can fit the behavior, you can study how this behaves here in this temperature range, and you will find that this goes down like 1 over T square. So delta will be proportional to T square in this temperature range.
And for each N, you are now at a fixed lattice spacing?
Well, what I'm doing, I'm changing the temperature by changing the coupling. So yeah, I have a fixed NT. Then I'm changing beta and so on.
And this NT, which is fixed,
yeah,
is the same for all Ns,
yeah,
of SUN. And
yeah,
how much is it?
This was 5, but for 3 plus 1. For the others, we have 6, 8, and 7 for 3 plus 1. Yeah. And actually, the work by Datta and Gupta, they compare 4, 6, and 8 also, and they found that 4 was the only one that was deviating most strongly.
Is there any, the fact that it goes as 1 over T squared, noticed some time ago by Pisarsky, never was explained.
Yeah.
So in this model, you say it's kind of analytically comes out.
No, actually not, because they solve the equations numerically to determine this curve. So, yeah. Actually,
it's still not clear why.
Actually, for the Polyakov loops, there is a similar thing, and Andrei had an analytical model where he could derive this T-square dependence in the renormalized Polyakov loop. So. Okay, so these are just the linear combinations, energy and entropy, linear combinations of P and delta. And now, another thing is, so how far are we from being conformal? So here, the simulations in this temperature regime are essentially from TC to something like 3.4 TC. So here I'm plotting P over T to the fourth as against the energy density over T to the fourth. And here in with these normalizations, essentially the line corresponding to conformal theories is this one. And these are the points starting from TC and going up in temperatures. So at temperature still close to TC, where there is the peak of delta over T to the fourth, we are very far from the conformal limit. But then as we go up around temperatures, say 3 TC or so, we see that we are quite close to being conformal. And this is reflected in the fact that these previous plots tend to become kind of flat at around 3 TC. But at the same time, we see that we are still very far from the trivial Stefan-Boltzmann limit, okay? So, in this temperature regime, we are kind of, I wrote here, quasi-conformal. It's not really, I mean, I don't want to imply any connection to models for, I don't know, walking technicolor or this kind of models, but here I'm just saying that this is a regime where we approach, these quantities approach a value which is more or less the same, almost independent of the temperature from 3 TC onwards. Of course, it still goes up, but logarithmically slow. Now, the other question, of course, is how strongly coupled are we then? So, here I'm plotting the results for the entropy density against the top coupling, the physical top coupling. This is in the, assuming the modified MS, so this is in the modified MS-bar scheme. So what I'm showing here, so the temperature is increasing when I move in this direction, and I'm also plotting this curve, which is the prediction which one would obtain for this quantity, namely the entropy density normalized to its value in the free case, that is obtained this time for n equals 4. This is an analytical prediction by Gabser, Klebanov, and Zeitlin. And this is the famous free quarter, and also the first correction due to the finiteness of the coupling is known, so this is not just 75%, but 75% plus something that goes like this. So in this temperature regime, we see, first of all, that the coupling lambda is, okay, it's not infinite, of course, but it's around 5.5 or so, if we are around 3 TC. And in that particular point is also where we are really very close to this curve. Of course, this could well be accidental, but it could also signal that indeed there is some universality and one can learn, one can get something also quantitative or maybe at least some semi-quantitative from this
n equals 4.
Yeah, this is of course a scheme-dependent statement. This was in the modified MS-bar scheme. So actually,
it calculated from bare coupling, right?
Well, this, yeah.
What's G?
Yeah, so this was the curve, I mean, the there is, you can rely on the two-loop perturbative computation for...
But for G of K, for bare coupling on the lattice K. It's not coupling at some point.
No,
it's on the lattice K.
Yeah, this I don't remember the value of, you mean the beta of the lattice simulations there. This I don't remember, but I don't remember.
This lambda is the lattice scale or the temperature scale?
No, this is the coupling, not the. I mean the temperature. Sorry.
The temperature scale.
Yeah.
So I'm confused how you're comparing things, because the key, your simulations, the goes down as lambda increases. Wait, I'm sorry.
This also.
Is that left? That's not flat. It is going down. It's going down more slowly.
Yeah.
So there's one scale or degrees, but.
Yeah, that's the problem. So if you want to go to strong coupling, you get confinement.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you want to stay in a plasma, then you get something quasi-conformal, but then coupling is about fine.
Yeah, so that's the point that I want to emphasize. I mean, there is this tension between the fact that if one wants to go conformal, then one is not strongly coupled anymore. So that's why I focus on particularly on reaching this temperature regime.
That is, by the way, maybe the appropriate point is that, however, as recent results with large number of flavors have shown, if you go to theories with many light fermions, you actually can go significantly further from coupling inside the plasma. Nearly factor 2, so it may help.
Yeah. But just I wanted to ask basically the same thing about lambda. So in the end of the day, this is the bare g squared times n?
No, this is this is obtained essentially from two-loop perturbation.
But you make a non-perturbative measurement of the coupling?
No, I didn't measure it. This is this because there are actually also some computations at large n with the Schrödinger function that have been done by Lucini and Moraitis, and they showed that you can go quite low in energies down to, I don't remember precisely where, but in this temperature regime, I mean, the point is that the temperature.
The question is,
what is your horizontal axis precisely?
Yes, what is lambda? So you say you take bare coupling G, and then you, with two loop function,
I computed, I used essentially the two-loop perturbative predictions to determine lambda as a function of the temperature.
So it's a scale, not a bar scale. So you start with the scale A, and then you go by your MT, factor 5, or whatever it is, using two-loop beta function.
Yeah.
And after that, you get your lambda at scale T, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
so
yes.
Now, of course, here there is also naturally a dependence on the scheme that one chooses, but I try to, I mean, the point is that this curve is relatively flat, and even if you change the scheme quite, I mean, those that the results that I obtained in different schemes were really kind of quite similar to what we show here. Also, another observation that I found later after putting the paper out was that there was also a similar comparison of some predictions from n equals 4 to results of this time full QCD with dynamical fermions, lattice computations for the drag force on heavy quarks. This was done by Gapser in 2006, and he also found that if one wants to compare n equals 4 with the phenomenologically relevant results, one should use a parameter lambda in this range. So this is precisely what we have here in that temperature regime. Okay, now comes this dependence of the trace anomaly on the temperature close to TC, as you pointed out already. Pizarski and several other groups had discussed this feature that already in SU3 one sees that the trace anomaly is close to the confinement temperature and up to say 3 or 4 times TC at least seems to be proportional to T square. Here I'm showing this by plotting delta over T to the fourth with the normalization as a function of TC over T square. So if delta is proportional to T square, this should be a straight line, and indeed this is what comes out. And the slope also, I mean, all the data fall on the same curve and the slope, so it seems to be universal and independent. This is just a plot of the extrapolation of the of these thermodynamic quantities to the Largen limit. Nothing special. This is just an answer for the functional form that I used to do the extrapolation. So the point is that in the for n going to infinity, there is a strong first-order phase transition with well-defined finite latent heat. Now, what happens in 2 plus 1 dimensions? Okay, first of all, here a smaller side related to the confined phase, close to TC. What we found is that the signal is much noisier, of course, because it's the delta is much smaller than in the deconfined phase. But what we found was that essentially one can model very well the behavior of thermodynamic quantities using just the gas of glue balls. And provided that when one reaches the temperature range close to TC, one includes the effect of the growth of the number of states. And we did this using essentially a slight variation on the old Isgurren Patton model in terms of a simple bosonic closed string. But okay, this is somehow just an observation. What the main focus is again to look at what happens in the deconfined phase, and again we see a perfect scaling with the number of gluon degrees of freedom. Here I'm plotting delta over T cube divided by n square minus 1, so I have changed the normalization with respect to the previous plot, okay? So here again we see that this curve fall on the same, this data fall on the same universal curve. And this is the first crude model, the first crude 2 plus 1 version of the holographic model that we cooked up just by including the expected limits for the scale factor in the ultraviolet and in the infrared with a given choice of only one parameter. And this seems already to describe relatively well the decay of this curve. What is interesting here that this curve doesn't go down like 1 over t squared, but 1 over t, which means here the dimensionless ratio is delta over t cube, because in 2 plus 1, which means again in 2 plus 1 delta is proportional to t squared, close to tc. So it's quite interesting.
In 2 plus 1 dimensions, the order of the phase transition changes with n, right?
Yeah.
So 2, 3, and perhaps 4 are second order. There's no change visible on your figure?
Well, 2, you can see that it's more smeared, essentially. But yeah.
About holographic model, so now we don't have beta function. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So you need somehow to fix parameters, how do you fix the parameters?
Yeah, this is discussed in the paper in detail. Essentially, T is reconstructed from the value of R where there is the transition from the phase that's dominated by the thermal graviton and the black hole.
Yeah, on the lattice also, if you change A, I mean, the lattice spacing, the continuum coupling is a lattice coupling squared divided by A, I guess. So
It's G squared. Yeah, G squared A is dimensionless.
Dimensionless. Yeah. So that means you could presumably look at correlation. If G is sufficiently small, it has to be very, very small. Then if you look at, you should see that correlations don't depend on anything except G squared A.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if people do that, but in 2 plus 1 when they do simulations, but it makes sense.
Yes, okay, well, I should think a bit of it.
How to define continuum limit?
Well, if G squared, if bare G squared, if dimensionless G squared is extremely small, then physical quantities should only depend on G squared A. So you can look at slightly small, you can look at slightly different but very small G squared and find that the results should be the same. At least it should be true.
Yeah, in sort of 2+1 dimensions, the gravity dual usually has, you know, the partition function scaling like n to the 3/2.
Yeah, this is one thing that this is actually in this construction that we used. This is not so.
So you're getting an n squared scaling in this case.
I already, this is, you're referring to this paper. There is this famous paper of Arnold and I think, and this is, it's...
That's been recovered in a field theory, this sort of so-called APJM model, which was...
But the construction here is different.
It's different. You're doing a Yang-Mills action, not transactions. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's pretty special to supersymmetry, too, because it has to do with, really to do with scalars, you know, you're close to the moduli space. So you're sort of between the n squared and the Yang. I suspect that would never be reduced in a non-supersymmetric theory that
if you didn't get into the 3/2,
no, I think it's probably larger than supersymmetry. It's down in the far infrared that supersymmetry protects. If you look at the D2 brain, there's a range of scales over which is n squared, and then in the far infrared it drops down to n to the 3/2. And this is more like the n squared.
Yep. So here again, a similar plot as the one that I showed previously for 3+1. In this case, for 2+1, again, it seems that the trace of the energy momentum tensor close to Tc is dominated by contributions which are proportional to T squared. So in this case, I'm plotting delta over T cube, this time as a function of Tc over T to reveal the linear behavior that one should see if delta is proportional to T squared. And indeed, this is again the case. So if one comes up with, if somebody comes up with the most welcome explanation for this phenomenological observation, it should be one which holds also in 2+1 dimension. So this was part of the motivation of this generalization to the lower dimensional scale. Finally, Polyakov loops. Okay, they are, of course, the they can be used to define. I mean, the Polyakov loop is just the order parameter for the deconfinement transition. And one important thing, of course, it requires renormalization because the bare Polyakov loop would just go to zero in the continuum. We have looked not only at different groups but also at different representations. There are several motivations for this. Maybe the one that we mostly focused on is Casimir scaling, but also at large end one expects some equivalence of different irreducible representations just based on group theoretical arguments combined with 1 over n arguments. Pizarski has suggested that also some of these higher representations could be interesting to discuss an effective matrix model close to Tc. And finally, looking at fermions fermions in different representations is very popular in the context of models for electro-weak symmetry breaking, so these extended technicolor models. But here we are just looking at the case of, we are not looking at dynamical fermions. Yeah, so how do we do the renormalization? Essentially, we look at how the static quark anti-quark potential at t equals zero behaves, and we extract from there the constant term in the potential that is responsible for the divergence of the free energy in the continuum limit. So this is a quantity which depends only on the on the bare coupling at which we are simulating. So essentially, the bare Polyakov loop depends both on the bare coupling that at which we are simulating and on the number of sites that we have in the temporal direction. So, whereas, of course, the renormalized Polyakov loop in a fixed scheme depends only on the temperature. So this we will express the renormalized Polyakov loop as a factor that depends on the bare coupling times the bare loop. Now there is in the context of holography there are some arguments that have been pointed out by Noronha a couple of years ago, suggesting that gauge string duality would imply, I mean, it's not a proof, but he had some arguments in his papers suggesting that the renormalized Polyakov loop in from gauge string duality should be monotonically increasing with the temperature. So it should start from zero at TC and then grow monotonically and reach one at infinity from below. This is at odds with the perturbative predictions, which show that the first correction at high temperature is actually positive. So the perturbative predictions would rather suggest that the Polyakov loop first grows, overshoots once, I mean the renormalized Polyakov loop grows, overshoots once, and then goes down, reaching one from above. So here, if we somehow find the temperature regime in which the Polyakov loop is still increasing, we also have some information about what is the temperature regime in which some arguments based on holography hold, namely what is the temperature regime in which we can consider the system strongly coupled enough to have this. But first, let me show you something about this this simpler issue related to the Casimir scaling.
Maybe just say that this is a very old issue, basically, that it goes from above. It simply means that if you have a point iron in a plasma, in the bi theory, the interaction of iron with the bi cloud is negative. That generate dissipates. So in some sense, it's essentially old phenomenon which is perturbing. So if some models, like holographic models, do not have it, then it means there is some other mechanism which is principally different from the bi-screening. The interaction of point charge with the medium has positive sign, not negative sign. Right? Which is a kind of qualitative feature nobody understands also.
Okay, but here I'm showing for the moment only bare loops, and then showing whether the Casimir scaling holds or not. So what is Casimir scaling? It's the expectation that the free energy associated with the Polyakov loop should be proportional to the eigenvalue of the quadratic Casimir in that given representation. So one way to see whether this holds or not consists in dividing the free energy of each representation by a quantity proportional to its Casimir, and that means if I define this d to be the ratio of the Casimir in a given representation over the fundamental, it means that if we raise the Polyakov loop, the bare Polyakov loop, to power 1 over d, different representations should all fall on the same curve. Here, in this study, we looked at the 12 lowest irreducible representations for all of these gauge groups. And the Casimir actually grows very fast for the smallest groups, like for SU2 and SU3. But still, you see that these curves tend to fall on the same band where the fundamental lies. And here you see actually at the beginning you have a lot of points which seem to be very far from this curve, but this is just because these are finite volume effects. Okay, so for these points, for these representations, they are blown up by this raising to this by having raised them to this power 1 over d, but actually it just means that the signal there is smaller than in those representations, the signal is smaller than the noise that comes from the fact that we are simulating on a finite lattice. Now, if we go to, this is quite general. This is, for example, I showed the SU2. We go here, we have SU3. And if you go high enough in with beta, namely, if you go essentially to large enough temperatures, you see that all of them will eventually reach this curve. So all the deviations from Casimir scaling seem to be only due to finite volume effects. And to test this, we also repeated simulations on different lattices, and we find that indeed they were going down. So if we repeated the simulations on a bigger lattice, these points here would move down, for example, here.
Where is the transition temperature on this?
Here it's, somewhere here.
So it's not a mystery, because here we are in very good coupling, right? So in recoupling, it is in agreement with perturbation theory.
Well, here close to TC, it's not so much. The thing is, precisely. Perturbation theory indeed predicts, at least at the lowest two orders, predicts exactly Casimir scaling. But the fact that it also holds down to temperatures close to TC is not obvious. Now here we have SU2, SU3. What happens when we go up with the number of colors? Actually, you find that the agreement tends to be nicer, and you see here the finite volume effects are not so relevant anymore. So here you see all the 12 lowest, out of the 12 lowest representations, essentially just one deviates very strongly from the universal, from this universal band. And why is this so? This is, it's quite nice that it has a very simple group theoretical interpretation. It's just due to the fact that the Casimir grows proportionally to n. So when you go up in the representations, here essentially we are already taking one n factor into account, because we are also dividing. I mean, this ratio is given by the ratio of the Casimir in a given representation over the one in the fundamental. So, roughly speaking, for SU6, I think the 12th representation had the factor D that was, if I remember, around 5, whereas for SU2, it was already, I think, 11 or so. Now I don't remember precisely the numbers, but I mean, the suppression of the finite volume effects at large n is due to this quite simple group theoretical argument. And you see that really also this explains quite naturally, it's also related, of course, to the fact that the difference between various representations, some representations do become equivalent at n equals infinity, as one would expect. Here is a plot of the renormalized Polyakov loop. In this plot, unfortunately, I'm not showing, so these are only the statistical errors, but there is still to be included the error that comes from the determination of Z. So this was, sorry about that. So this there should be an error band which is a bit wider than this tiny points that we have here, but still, close to TC would be something of this order, so it doesn't really change the picture very drastically. And what we see is that, of course, here the computations are challenging, because it's difficult to extract this renormalization scale non-perturbatively, I mean with this method that we are using on very fine lattices. But still, it's enough to see that, similarly to what happens in SU3, that has been studied in mostly in this paper and also in this previous one, what one finds is that indeed, so at the phase transition, the renormalized Polyakov loop jumps to a value close to 1/2, then it goes up, it crosses 1 at temperatures around 3 or 4 TC, and then it goes up. And if you go on further, okay, our determination of Z will eventually rely only on an extrapolation if we went further, but you would see that at the end it turns, it bends down. I mean, at the temperatures around.
Can I ask, I don't quite understand this whole issue. So separately, below TC, there are string tensions. String tensions have different dependence on representation. That's a different issue.
Yeah.
Now you are above TC. So if you have a diagram with one gluon, it certainly has a Casimir.
Yeah.
If you have more complicated diagrams, they are not having just Casimir. They have some other factors.
Mm-hmm.
So you are checking what? You are checking the role of these more complicated diagrams? Or?
Yeah, so from perturbation theory, there is the expectation that there is a violation of to Casimir scaling at high order. I don't remember if it's the
so
next
some high order. So you, in principle, there are predictions you can plot, right?
Yeah.
You just didn't plot them.
Yeah, actually, I was, I think we will, in the paper, we will plot them here. For the renormalized Polyakov loop, actually, the predictions from these two recent papers, so there is a curve that goes up like here and here.
Okay.
So it's a bend, and the bend is defined essentially, it's related to the way that you define precisely the bimass. Here, the thing is that at these temperatures here, they go up quite wildly.
So you're saying you don't plot it because they agree on the outside?
Yeah, actually, we find that they agree if we go in the region where our determination of Z becomes an extrapolation. So maybe we will plot it in the paper to have some comparison, but I mean, also in this paper they showed the results up to 2040 C, but there I think it was also an extrapolation. So, but the point is that essentially also the renormalized Polyakov loop is quite similar for different gauge groups. Here you see also for SU5 the behavior is again very similar. It jumps at one, it jumps from close to 1/2, then it goes up, and then around 3 TC or so, it crosses 1. Again, here, the error bars in this case related to the determination of Z would be slightly larger, but the picture is quite similar to what we had for SU4 and the same as for that was obtained here for SU3. By the way, I repeated this thing that it jumps to 1/2 because this is precisely what happens also in 1+1 dimensions. So, of course, it doesn't mean too much, but it could be that there is something general about this. Okay, so finally, another signature of something non-perturbative in the Polyakov loop is something that had been pointed out, I think, in the first page, first by this group. So they observe that if one plots the logarithm of the renormalized Polyakov loops close to TC, this quantity seems to behave proportionally to 1 over t square. So here they did this for SU3, and here I'm doing the same for SU4 and SU5. And again, this seems to be the case. So in a temperature range which is roughly between 1.3 TC to something like 3 or 4 TC, we see that this behavior is quite clearly observed. And this is precisely the same temperature range where there is this T-square dependence in the free, yeah, in delta. And why are we cutting the region for temperatures below 1.3 TC? Just because there is always some, the numerical results from the lattice are mostly most sensitive to artifacts, essentially.
But did this plot, doesn't this whole thing depend on which scheme you choose for a renormalized Polyakov loop?
Yeah. Yeah, but actually what they had observed is they had observed this for SU3 where they had defined it in a slightly, in a different scheme. And yeah, so maybe the slope would change, of course, but.
Uh-huh. I mean, isn't it that the if I change the scheme, then the renormalized Poiseuille loop will change something like e to the minus something over t. Mm. So then you take the logarithm, it will bring you something like 1 over t. So that it will not screw up your 1 over t squared if just by changing a scheme.
Let me see. So yeah, you have. Yeah, you're saying you're just adding something to the renormalized free energy, so free energy over t would change. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's.
So maybe you choose a scheme which specifically doesn't have this term or something. Maybe your scheme is defined by this property or something. Mm, like that, no?
Yeah. But there is also another issue that when you fix the scheme, you should. I mean, it's most natural also to fix this constant in such a way that you expect it to go to zero for t going to infinity. So maybe that all sorts that out, I think. So, yeah. Okay. So this is just a summary of the conclusions, so of these results. So the lattice computations show essentially a perfect scaling with n squared minus 1, both in for the equation state and the deconfined phase, both for 3 plus 1 and 2 plus 1. So this is, I think, good news for applying holographic models because they are relying on this infinite n approximation. And this model that we looked at provides quantitatively quite good description of the results. Then I also made this comparison with the caveats that I mentioned, with the prediction from for the entropy density in n equals 4 in this temperature regime, in particular here where we have quite strongly coupled but already nearly conformal regime. And there is this issue of the possibly non-perturbative dependence of delta on t squared. And finally, this was more or less an aside of the global model with the bosonic combined with the bosonic string model for the equation state and the confined phase. And finally, for the renormalized, for the Poiseuille loops, we find very good Casimir scaling properties, and this renormalized loop that behaves again very similarly, in a very similar way compared to by comparing different gauge groups, and there is possibly a regime in which it's dominated by some non-perturbative contributions. So that's all. Thanks for your attention.
We go to questions, but after questions we discuss some organizational things, so don't disappear. So questions?
You probably said it already, but I couldn't follow that. In the end of the day, how many parameters does this model have that you need to fix to something, and then how many predictions do you have?
Yeah, okay, so in 3 plus 1, they imposed they looked at the behavior that the potential should have in the ultraviolet and in the infrared, and they have two parameters in the ultraviolet and two in the infrared. So they fixed those in the ultraviolet by imposing that they would reproduce the first two coefficients of the beta function, and in the infrared they fitted two lattice results. I think the lightest global mass of SU3 and the value of the latent heat extrapolated at n equals infinity that they obtained from the old paper by Tepper and collaborators. So essentially there is a mixture of, actually there is an interesting observation that since they combine these two, some information for SU3 and some from SU infinity, for example, is related to the fact that the curve that they plot, where is it? I think the curve that they obtain for delta over t to the fourth has a kind of a slightly strange feature. Here it has a kind of a maximum here, and this most likely is just I mean, I expect that for n going to infinity, one would, I mean, it would be decreasing. The finiteness of this peak, I think, is just related to artifacts due to the finiteness of n. And also this peak becomes sharper. I mean, here the black points, which are for SU3, show that the peak is a bit more smeared out, so it's at a slightly larger value of t, and slightly lower also. And when you go to larger values of n, you see that the curves tend to become a bit sharper. And you can define also the extrapolated latent heat like quite.
Nobody tried to discuss one of n corrections
In the holographic model, no, not that I know.
Okay. If there are no questions, thank you again.